Coming up next on 51%, we'll hear about a men's group that came together a few years ago and has met regularly ever since.
One of the tenets of the group is that what's talked about in men's group stays in men's group.
And there's a film in the works about the difficulty in finding affordable housing for formerly incarcerated mothers. These stories and more are next on 51%. This week's 51%, we learn about an anti-sexist men's group.
I think pretty early on, one of the main things that we all agreed is that a lot of people in the group were relying on relationships with women for emotional support, and we saw that as one of the ways that like sexism was playing out in our lives.
A documentary about formerly incarcerated mothers is in the works, and Dr. Jerry Burns returns with an essay on bathroom message art. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. What is an anti-sexist men's group? And if a man identifies as progressive with feminist values, isn't that enough? Well, Felix Poon explores these questions by talking to a few members of a men's anti-sexism group in Boston, Massachusetts.
Sometimes I'll just say I'm in a men's group, and people will ask, what kind of men's group is, I think, is the question that I get most frequently. And I'm pretty sure they're trying to figure out whether I'm in like an alt-right men's rights group, or if it's something else. It's like, what the hell are a group of men doing getting together and being in a group with only men? And so I usually say it's an anti-sexist men's group, and then people basically say, phew. Okay, good.
This is Matthew Hepburn. Matthew was invited to join a men's anti-sexism group in 2016. I was there. Matthew and I have been friends for years, and I was hosting a dinner party at my house. Two other mutual friends of ours were there, and they were part of the men's group. They told us about it and invited us to join.
I remember you were pretty excited about it.
This is me talking to Matthew.
You had a lot of questions, you were asking him about it. For me, on the other hand, I internally scoffed at the idea. I didn't voice this, but I kind of thought, I'm a feminist man, like I have progressive values, I'm anti-sexist. Like,
you were too good for this men's group.
I was too good for this men's group. That's what I thought.
But Matthew was totally fascinated. He'd been reflecting on male privilege for some time, reading feminist books, and examining the events of his life and how they were shaped by gender. He said he'd just hit a wall because he was doing it in isolation by himself. So he went to a meeting.
My first men's group was totally mind-blowing. It was one of the early warm nights in the year, I think. And we sat outside in the backyard, and the sun was slowly setting, and so it was getting darker and darker. And by the time we left, it was totally dark. And one of the guys was talking about his struggles with his partner, who he had been with for a long time.
Matthew requested that I protect the confidentiality of the guy he's talking about here. One of the tenets of the group is that what's talked about in men's group stays in men's group. That way, everyone feels safe to be vulnerable. What we need to know here is that this guy and his partner were struggling through a tough time in their relationship, and it was his relationship with her that he usually went to for emotional support.
I watched this group of men really, with so much care and compassion, challenge this guy at every turn of the conversation. And it just opened this guy up. I watched him go through waves of anger and defiance at what was happening. I watched him go through just openly weeping. I watched him go through self-acceptance. I watched him go through tremendous compassion for his partner. And the whole time, the group itself was just maintaining this steady, committed, kind, compassionate witnessing and challenging of what he was expressing was going on for him. I had never seen anything like it. And it was the very first group that I went to. And I was like, holy shit, something super radical is happening here. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this for as long as I possibly can. It's like, I want some of this. I want to learn how to be as skillful as the guys who are, you know, mirroring what they're mirroring for this guy. And I also want to be in this guy's seat where I have people who I trust to like bring about and catalyze massive growth.
The group that Matthew joined grew out of the Boston-based chapter of the National Organization of Men Against Sexism, or NOMAS. NOMAS organized a 6-week discussion group on race and masculinity in 2015, and at the end of the 6 weeks, a number of the participants decided to keep the group going. They've met every other week since. Several of the original members are still with the group, including John Barry.
It couldn't be theoretical. It had to be tied to, like, your lived experience. We could talk about theory all we want, and that's not going to get us anywhere, right? Let's actually talk about our lives, you know?
Right.
And I think pretty early on, one of the main things that we all agreed is that a lot of people in the group were relying on relationships with women for emotional support, and we saw that as one of the ways that, like, sexism was playing out in our lives. It was, like, putting this emotional labor on women, and we wanted this space, the space of the group, to explicitly be a space for emotional support.
Equity in emotional labor was not a tenet that I expected was a part of a men's anti-sexism group, at least not until I experienced a breakup in the fall of 2017 that got me thinking. I'd relied almost entirely on women for emotional intimacy, and usually on whoever my romantic partner is at the time. So after my breakup, I was feeling pretty lonely. And that's when I remembered the men's group that Matthew joined. So instead of jumping back into the dating scene and repeating my old patterns, I decided I needed close relationships with men. I decided to join the group. And then this happened.
Latest on Harvey Weinstein, the New York Times reporting allegations by numerous women who say the Hollywood mogul sexually harassed.
This morning, Larry Nassar, a top sports doctor who treated Olympic athletes, is facing 22 criminal charges of sexual abuse.
More breaking news now, hours after Kevin Spacey was accused of sexual assault of a minor.
Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore is still adamantly denying allegations of sexual misconduct with minors decades ago.
The comedian Louis C.K. Is responding to allegations of sexual misconduct.
New accusations against Matt Lauer. NBC fired the Today Show host after a woman came forward Monday evening with allegations. Now more are telling their stories.
In response to these events, people, mostly women, took to social media and shared their personal stories with sexual assault. The Me Too movement began.
Was there a diversity of reactions or thoughts to the Me Too movement?
Well, there's no, I think in any one person, there's a diversity of reactions and thoughts. Yeah. And so, you know, different people at different times picked up different threads that they were really interested in. So some people immediately were most compelled by the conversations around consent and rape culture. Other people were really interested in diving into exploring what's cancel culture about.
For those who aren't familiar with the term cancel culture, I'm going to turn to another member of the group, Dee. Dee is a public defender, and he asked to remain anonymous because of his job. He explained that the criminal justice system is an institutional example of cancel culture.
So that is one type of canceling that's extreme, when we're just like, I literally want you out of public spaces, right? But I think Men's Group was the first time I thought about it in our individual lives, where it's like, it's easier for us to like debate with someone online and literally hit the block button than it is to sort of like ask the question of like, what makes you feel that way? Like, we're all f***ed up, we're all traumatized, we all have things that cause us to react in ways that are maybe not consistent with the rest of us, and figuring out like how to get someone to a place that's compassionate. But on the other hand, right, like, there are things that people do that like are not acceptable, right? And so how do you find that line? And I think as men, we have a special need to do that, because many of us have said and done things in regards to misogyny where it's like, you know, I to try to prove my masculinity in high school, I told jokes that were like offensive. And I know that I did that. Like, that kind of thing causes harm, and harm that I've never been accountable for, right? So if I were to interact with someone who was like, oh, I remember you did this thing, it hurt me, right? And I'm never speaking to you again. I mean, anyone's entitled to say or do that, but we are also entitled as people to like witness something bad and offer someone the chance to change. So it's like, you know, thinking about how do we, I mean, we don't win liberation together by removing one person at a time until there's nobody left. So there has to be some way to get the world to a place that we want without losing all of the people in the process.
In the early days of the Me Too movement, one of my reactions was relief. I felt relieved that I'd never done something so heinous as those men. My hands were clean, I thought. But it didn't sit right with me to absolve myself so easily. So I replayed my entire sexual history through my mind, and I recalled a time I pressured a partner to have sex. I reached out to her and apologized for what I did. And I brought this story into Men's Group, and we talked about it. We talked about consent and rape culture as we examined the gendered scripts we'd all learned to play in bed. We talked about enthusiastic consent and how to practice it. Without my Men's Group, I don't think I would have processed any of this to the degree that I did. So I've grown as a feminist man by being in this group. But is self-growth enough? Some members of our group want to take a more active response to issues like sexual assault. John is of that line of thought.
Sexual violence is happening all the time. You know, it's like 1 in 4 women will be raped in their life. 1 in like 8 or 9 men.
It's actually 1 in 5 women and 1 in 38 men, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But you get the point that John's making. Sexual assault is common, especially for women.
And it's mostly men who are doing the violence. So there needs to be a way to handle it. Restorative justice, transformative justice processes are one way to do that.
John went on to explain that a transformative justice process involves talking with the person who was harmed, as well as the person who did the harm, and figure out what each of them needs in order to move forward in a good way, taking into account the community of friends and family around these two and how they're impacted, and how they're going to relate to these two people moving forward.
With Me Too, the idea that we need to respond better as a society has just become more clear in like the social consciousness. And who's gonna do that? Individual men? No, you don't have the capacity to respond to a community that's been impacted by sexual violence as an individual man. Doesn't work. Too hard. You need to be part of a group of people who can support you and sustain you in doing that, and who can be a resource to do the work that's needed to, like, hold that person who's caused harm in community.
I think John's vision makes sense. He says that we need a community infrastructure to support this work, and men's groups can be a part of that infrastructure, and that every man needs to be a part of a group like that, to be vulnerable and do the internal work on themselves, but also to do the external work to hold each other accountable. John used a metaphor for men's groups. I think it makes a lot of sense. He said that patriarchy is like a river. You can be a feminist man on your own and try to swim upstream against its currents. But it's a lot easier if you team up with a group of other men, and together you can paddle up that river way easier. So as it turns out, I'm not too good for men's anti-sexism groups. In fact, no man is.
Again, that was Felix Poon reporting. A jury has found that Johnson & Johnson's talcum-based powder did not cause a St. Louis woman's ovarian cancer. In late December, the jury ruled in a lawsuit brought by 56-year-old Vicki Forrest, who testified she has used Johnson & Johnson's baby powder for 32 years. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 2012. The lawsuit is among several filed on behalf of thousands of women who have sued the company, claiming its talcum powder caused ovarian cancer or mesothelioma. Johnson & Johnson has said its products are safe and do not cause cancer. For 60 years, Cuba's communist government has monopolized virtually every aspect of life on the island, including state-controlled organizations that serve as official advocates for groups ranging from LGBT people to animal lovers. And in 2019, that monopoly began to loosen with the appearance of independent activist groups. One of the most important is women's rights. Women loosely organizing over Cuba's year-old mobile internet have successfully pushed the government for new protections against domestic abuse and published statistics on gender-motivated killings. An online campaign brought international attention to Cuban women, claiming assault and harassment by partners and co-workers. A State University of New York at New Paltz professor is working on a documentary about formerly incarcerated mothers in New York and their challenges in reentry and finding affordable housing. I spoke with filmmaker Megan Sperry about Beyond Shelter. Sperry, a Kingston resident, is working on the feature-length documentary. She got the idea for it while working on her first film, The Domino Effect. That 2012 film is about the gentrification of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and the rezoning of the former Domino sugar refinery to accommodate luxury condos with a small percentage of affordable housing. And she saw affordable housing for formerly incarcerated women as a topic worth exploring in another film, given the mothers' difficulties in reentry, becoming reunited with their children, and limited access to resources.
People usually, when I talk about the film, they're like, oh, it's so specific, you know? And I'm like, yeah, it is really specific. But in focusing on this thing, right, that it's affordable housing for formerly incarcerated mothers, which is a mouthful, right, it really does bring to light a lot of different issues, right, that are surrounding either incarceration or reentry or criminal justice or affordable housing or, you know, any of these things. So I don't know, it just feels like it's a really timely subject. It's something that a lot of people don't want to think about, but once they do, kind of it's brought to their attention, they're like, oh yeah, you know, and that's really why I'm making the film. One of the biggest surprises is how many entities are kind of like at the table around this issue and how much of a lack of transparency there is between the entities, right? So you have like federal stakeholders, you have state stakeholders, you have city or local stakeholders, you have nonprofit organizations, and they all know that they're at the table, they all know that they're doing work at the table, but they're not necessarily working together to streamline, you know, reentry or to help people get back on their feet or to start like innovative programming that would, you know, really set somebody up for a successful reentry.
Her film branches out from New York City to include other parts of the state.
I started thinking about this in New York City, and then I moved to the Hudson Valley and I realized, you know, because geographically of where we're situated, right, a lot of people from the city become incarcerated upstate. And then a lot of decisions about criminal justice and incarceration take place on the Albany level, right? So it's not just a city thing, it's actually a state thing, right? Affordable housing is not just an issue in New York City, it's actually a pretty big issue statewide. So I really thought, okay, well, I'm going to focus on New York City and New York State, and I'm going to look at how it's happening, you know, what's happening here in New York State as like a micro study, and then I would also like to compare that to what's happening nationally.
Sperry, an assistant professor in digital media and journalism at SUNY New Paltz, has a timeline for Beyond Shelter.
So I'm in production now. So I'm still filming. I'm, you know, meeting with my subjects. I'm working with, you know, people that are doing work either as at the nonprofit level, organizational level, or, you know, politicians. So I'm still, it's in progress. And the goal is to kind of have filming wrapped by next fall and start cutting it then, editing. And really, I started this whole project thinking, like, I wanted this to be a teaching tool. I wanted it to be something that people could use as a way of educating people about the issue and hopefully advocating for change.
Sperry also teaches a spring course on women in film called REEL, that's R-E-E-L, Women.
I mean, because I'm an educator and because I understand how, you know, the power of film can really affect change and how people are using film more and more as like a teaching tool, I really am approaching this film like from that perspective, understanding, you know, the end game is to have it have educational distribution and distribution that will help create a platform and create a space for conversations around this issue. So I'm using both of my toolboxes for this project.
Sperry's first film, The Domino Effect, continues to serve as a teaching tool for universities and social justice organizations across the U.S. Again, her film currently in production is called Beyond Shelter. And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns delves into message art in bathrooms.
Bathrooms made headlines when a toilet was stolen from England's Blenheim Palace. Now, if you are not privy to this news story, I'll tell you this. It probably wasn't stolen because the royal family sat on that throne. It was most likely stolen for its value. You see, that pricey potty is made of solid gold. In all seriousness, though, it's a valuable work of art created by the artist Maurizio Catalan. Blenheim Palace is not the only place to host Catalan's golden commode. The Guggenheim Museum in New York City had it, too. Nancy Spector, a curator there, told NPR that the toilet, named America, makes a statement. Yes, I would say that a solid gold poop receptacle named after a country makes quite the statement. But there's more. The golden seat is fully functional. According to Spector, people did more than view it when it was at the Guggenheim. They used it. In so doing, they had an up-close and personal experience with art. And art had quite the experience of them. Catalan sends multiple messages with his solid gold rendition of America. And sending messages in bathrooms is apparently a thing. I was in a local library recently doing historical research among old papers, esoterica, and faded pictures. It was a nerd's delight. Eventually, I needed to visit the facilities, though. When I opened the door, I laughed out loud. The toilet had a message taped to the open lid. This way to the Ministry of Magic. Beneath the words was an arrow which pointed straight down into the bowl. Harry Potter lovers know this reference. In the world of J.K. Rowling, it's possible to travel many ways, like through fireplaces or by holding on to powerful objects. But you can also flush yourself down a toilet to arrive at the magical world's version of the DMV. Well, that tiny little message on the toilet made my stay in that room of requirement a bit more enjoyable than it otherwise would have been. In addition to literary references and lavatories, I've come upon personal and socially oriented messaging as well. One place where I regularly see this is at my dad's. His partner plasters sticky notes all over the bathroom mirror. "You are perfect" is one of her favorites. But her Lou is not the only one with uplifting messages. In a high school in Raleigh, North Carolina, I beheld colorful, artistic messaging on every black bathroom stall door. One said, "Throw kindness around like confetti." Another said, "Be bold, be brave, be you." The messages on the doors were eye-catching and mind-catching. Beautifully crafted words were surrounded by pleasing, colorful accents of shapes and designs, and one stalled door was a bit cheeky. It said, "Way to go." I was mostly touched that positivity graffiti was supported by the school administration. Promoting positive self-image and pro-social connections is a really good thing. And Raleigh lavatories are not the only bathrooms where it happens, with an apologetic nod to Lin-Manuel Miranda for that one. Teachers and staff painted positive messages in bathrooms in a middle school during summer break in Forney, Texas. And this only scratches the porcelain surface of this trend. It must be a trend if decals for bathroom stall affirmations are available online and the term bathroom stall, with pictures of such messaging, has its own board on Pinterest. While positive messaging for school bathrooms is wonderful, what about loos in other locations? Well, some places are ahead of the curve on that. Minturn, Colorado, once a mining town, hosts a set of bathrooms for men and women that look like mine entrances. Philadelphia's Longwood Gardens has a greenway, which is a hallway with bathroom stalls embedded in lush walls carpeted with thick greenery. Norway has a beautiful bathroom that some people say is the most beautiful in the world. Complete with frosted glass walls, the bathroom sits at the edge of a fjord. Who wouldn't find relief from a stressful day in such a bathroom with a view? Municipalities already beautify public spaces with flowers, decorative lights, and murals. Why not give public bathrooms a facelift, too? I don't know about you, but I wouldn't mind being treated to beautiful thoughts or images in those private moments, especially in desolate highway rest stop restrooms. So let's eliminate dreary bathrooms. We can uplift the toilet bound with artistic imagery or positive affirmations. No need for 24-karat gold toilets or even gold-flecked toilet paper dispensers. A few kind words and artful images will lighten the drab and add positivity to the dinge. I hope my little potty talk will inspire people to install beauty and positivity in stalls everywhere. That way we can follow the lead of Maurizio Catalan and make the business of doing one's business an art.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1589.